when we see violence in the news, terror attacks in Paris or California, the rising number of shootings in Milwaukee, stories of domestic violence, we might wonder, what kind of person would do such a thing? There's often an assumption that the perpetrator was lacking a moral code. They were sadistic or psychopathic, or they had that moral code but lost their grip. They acted on impulse.
But our next guest says that many violent acts are seen by the perpetrator as upholding their moral code, their vision of what society should be. Far from being seen as an immoral act or a mistake in judgment, violence is seen as a necessary, even a positive action, despite all the harm that can be done. And he says that if we don't understand the causes of violence, it's going to be very difficult to reduce violence in the future.
Tage Rye joins us now. He's a postdoctoral research associate and lecturer at MIT's Sloan School of Management. He's co-author of the book Virtuous Violence, Hurting and Killing to Create, Sustain, End, and Honor Social Relationships. Tage, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, as we mentioned, it's tempting to think of perpetrators of, say, a violent crime as a villain or a sadist or a psychopath. You're right, that happens, but it's not really the norm, is it?
No, I mean, I think everyone wants to live in a world where perpetrators know that what they're doing is wrong and then they do it anyway. But that's just not really the world we live in. So, you know, we can think about sadists, we can think about psychopaths, and actually they just account for really less than 10% of violence around the world. So then we have to ask the question, what motivates the rest of us? And at least in our book, when we look across history, across cultures, what we find is that most perpetrators of violence really fundamentally believe that what they're doing is the right thing, or at least that's what they feel deep to their core.
Right. And before we dig deeper into that, I think another assumption, as we mentioned, is that this might have been a decent person. They had a lapse. They were angry. They had a momentary lapse of reason, and that led them to do this thing. And again, you say, no, that the evidence doesn't seem to point to that either. So ideas of if we just had more self-control, we'd have less violence. Maybe that wouldn't pan out.
Sure. I mean, academics have known for a long time that most killers aren't really sadistic or psychopathic. And so then the argument has been that, well, they know that what they're doing is wrong, but they just do it anyway, either because they gave in to temptation or because of a momentary lapse. So somebody had a tough day at work, they get frustrated, they take it out on their partner, even though they know it's wrong. What we find is that although that may happen, that in itself isn't really a good explanation. So the fact that I was upset still doesn't give me an answer into why was I upset in the first place.
Right.
So that makes sense. That in other words, a lot of our theories really focus on how the conditions that keep us from being violent, things like self-control, empathy, how those things break down, but they don't get the other side of the equation of why did I want to hurt somebody in the first place.
And so why? And you started to touch on that a few moments ago. We feel when we commit an act of violence, whether it's something that's later regarded as crime or a heroic act if we're defending our fellow soldiers in war, in all those cases, for the most part, we think we're doing something right, morally right, or maintaining a social order, you write.
Yes, that's essentially true, that when we look at what perpetrators say, when we look at historical documents, when we look at ethnographies, when we look at observations of war, of genocide, of initiation rites, of spousal abuse, of any kind of violence you can come up with, what we see are people who think that their violence is both right and obligatory, that to not be violent would be seen as morally wrong in their eyes.
So let's spell it out. In a case like maybe when we think of an inner city shooting or an act of domestic violence, the perpetrator is thinking what? That something has been done, some offense that has been done to them, and to make things right, they have to react violently?
Potentially, in those cases. So sometimes, if we look at the inner city gang case, it's going to be retaliation. Something has been done to them. They need to do something back. Oftentimes, something was done to their group. Now that entitles them to attack somebody in the other group. A lot of times that violence, though, may be part of initiation. As part of joining the group, you need to attack some other group. We can look at something like you brought up spousal abuse just now. There, the motivations are still going to be moral but might take a different flavor. Perhaps the in most cases, the husband thinks that his wife is or partner is a legitimate subordinate and she's disrespecting his authority. Therefore, he feels that it's his place to attack her and discipline her in that sense.
Well, Tate, I mean, this is pretty disturbing in a way, because there's this really positive element of being a human, our social connectedness, and yet in these cases and so many others, we're turning that social connectedness that makes us human into a justification for violence.
That's right. I mean, when we say that violence is morally motivated, there's this question of, well, what is it morally motivated toward? And what it's motivated toward is regulating the kinds of important social relationships in all of our lives. Oftentimes, we're going to be able to regulate those relationships through nonviolent means. And so then the question is, how do we get people who are regulating through violent means to shift toward regulating in nonviolent ways? If you end up hitting my dog with your car, I could come up to you and talk to you about it and perhaps call the authorities and get your license revoked, or I could pull out a gun and shoot you. How do we shift people from one option to the other?
We're talking to Tage Rye. He researches the causes of violence. He's the co-author of the book Virtuous Violence, Hurting and Killing to Create, Sustain, End, and Honor Social Relationships. And Tage, I want to run with that last point you brought up. Obviously, in most societies, the goal is to reduce the amounts of violence, to reduce violent crime. We've already talked about maybe self-control, boosting self-control isn't the answer given the causes. So if there's this fundamental idea that people feel that they're doing the right thing when they commit violent crimes, how do you change that? It's not just changing that person in that case, is it?
No, I mean, if we look at violence, we know that, you know, if we look at something like gun violence, it's often caused by people in cases where people are socially disadvantaged and when they're coming from communities where gun violence is condoned. So that means that we have to approach it by both giving people other opportunities to gain respect, to gain legitimacy through nonviolent means. So all the sorts of social structural approaches to changing that social disadvantage, giving people jobs, giving people homes. And then to also support the kinds of community interventions that leverage third-party relationships to perpetrators so that the people that perpetrators care about, the people that perpetrators care about, can force them toward nonviolence, right? To show them that they believe and they feel that violence is wrong, that it is hurting their relationships within the broader community.
Well, let's turn this to the problem of terrorism now. A terrorist in this model feels like it'd be morally wrong not to take violent action in many cases for offenses done to the Muslim community in some cases, in Northern Ireland, to the Catholic or Protestant communities in years past, a lot of non-religious reasons too. So how can a community change the mindset of people so that they don't view violence as a moral imperative, as a moral right action?
I mean, there's a lot of layers to the question of terrorism. One is about how do you get it off the ground, and then once it's going, how do you stop it? If we look at terrorists, a lot of times they really are not just hating the West and trying to combat them. They're also trying to join into a particular group. They're trying to be part of something. They're trying to get meaning in their lives. So this means we need to provide people with alternative ways of meaning that they can find within those communities. It also means that if many of them are being motivated by a sense of retaliation, then we need to make sure that that gets quelled at the beginning. So, you know, if we look at something like the rise of ISIS, we have this question of, well, where did it come from? And if we think about the fact that, you know, hundreds of thousands of Iraqi noncombatant civilians died during the Iraq War, then we have to ask the question whether if any fraction of those deaths led people to radicalize, and if so, then that multiplies the number of terrorists tenfold.
And I think it was in your piece I read that there can be value in respected members of a community really trying to set standards, maybe new standards or maybe revising old standards, to make it clear to members of their own community that that violence is not a moral act. Is that something that can make a difference, whether we're talking about international terrorism or violence in an American city?
Sure. If we look at gang violence interventions, you can look at work by David Kennedy in Baltimore, I think, where they've really focused on developing these kinds of interventions that enable killers to be confronted by members of their communities in the face of, you know, coupled with potential material consequences by police, to show them that actually, in fact, their violence isn't supported. And that when you do that, when you have those kind of community-based interventions, the effectiveness is much stronger than when we try to add material consequences purely alone. And that makes sense, because we're getting more and more work to suggest that if someone's motivated to kill by non-material moral benefits, then they're not going to respond to material costs like going to jail in the same way that someone who's just killing for money would.
Tej, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Tej Rai from MIT. His piece on violence, by the way, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.